The problem is that what tools do the police have to solve community problems? They have guns and handcuffs and tasers and pepper spray and ticket books. They have punitive tools backed up by violence.
Welcome to Ideas. I'm Nahla Ayed. And this is the American sociologist Alex Vitale.
And what communities are asking for now is not more training and better recruiting and more accountability or anti-bias, you know, initiatives. They're asking for us to quit using violence workers to solve our community problems.
Today, part two of our series on the role police play in society. We'll look at the current state of policing, its culture, the increased use of military tactics, and its struggles when responding to complex social crises such as mental health emergencies, and whether meaningful reform is possible, and if so, what is the path forward? We're calling this program Rethinking Policing. It's presented by Ideas contributor Kyle G. Brown. And a warning, this episode contains descriptions of graphic violence.
What should be the role of police in society? It's a fraught and complex question.
Well, I don't think we know the answer to that question. I think we know that it needs to be something dramatically different than what we have today.
Alex Vitale is a professor of sociology at Brooklyn College in New York.
5-6 years ago, when we had the last major round of protests, people were told that the problem was going to get fixed, that the Obama administration, big city mayors, police chiefs said, don't worry, we're going to implement a whole set of reforms. We're going to give police better training. We're going to give them body cameras. We're going to increase accountability mechanisms. And then what happened in Minneapolis seemed to indicate, you know, nothing has changed. And in fact, across the country, the same number of people are being killed by police. And no one in heavily policed communities is going around talking about how fantastic the police have become. The problem remains. And neither political party seems to have any interest in actually doing anything other than symbolism about it.
And the policing crisis is widespread. In Canada, as we discussed in part one of this series, 2020 was one of the deadliest years for police shootings. After the killing of George Floyd by a police officer in Minneapolis, protesters took to streets around the world, calling for an end to police violence in their own countries. Mike Huff is Emeritus Professor at the School of Law, Birkbeck University of London. He says there needs to be less reliance on hard power, the use of coercive force to influence people's behavior.
I think the first thing that police must do if they're to work their way out of hard power traps is to understand the dynamics of overuse of hard power, because it's not self-evident that using hard power can actually trap you in nothing but hard power. And once you've bought into that, I think you need to be given the tools to find other ways of dealing with conflict.
But police continue to deploy hard power, including the use of heavily armed tactical units. Kevin Walby is Associate Professor of Criminal Justice at the University of Winnipeg. In 2018, along with researcher Brendan Rosier, he published a study on the use of police tactical units in Canada.
We used Freedom of Information requests to get at the deployment numbers for tactical units with municipal police in Canada and regional and provincial police in Canada. And we found that the deployments have gone up.
The data covered the period from 2007 to 2017.
And we found that in that decade, some cities, notably Winnipeg, but others, saw an incredible spike in the use of the tactical teams.
In 2000, police agencies used tactical units on average 60 times that year. By 2017, Walby and Rosier found that number rose to more than 1,000 times a year.
So with SWAT teams or tactical units, they definitely have different gear, and people are probably familiar with that. They have different uniforms. They're not the stereotypical so-called boys in blue anymore. They might be wearing black or gray kind of camo gear, or sometimes they're just totally unmarked in a lot of dynamic entries or no-knock entries. They don't have any uniforms on, and they're unmarked as officers.
When SWAT teams were introduced in the 1970s, these types of highly militarized tactical teams were used for situations such as public shooter incidents, a hostage crisis, or hijacking. And their methods often differ from regular policing.
And then you have a different kind of strategy as it regards use of force, as it regards engagement with the public. Instead of treating everyone as if they have the benefit of doubt on their side, approaching them with reasonable probable grounds and things like the 1+1 force rule.
The 1+1 rule advocates an officer use only one level of force greater than the level of resistance used by the person being questioned or arrested.
But tactical teams have a different set of terminology. They're less concerned about fulfilling the potential of due process in criminal law, and they're more focused on immediate threats and risk. And they may use different strategies to extinguish those risks, even if that means injuring or killing persons.
And the role of tactical squads in regular policing is expanding.
What the findings reveal is that tactical teams and tactical members are used very frequently in Canadian policing on a daily basis. And this kind of goes against general understandings of what tactical teams are supposed to be used for.
SWAT units are now being deployed for more routine situations, says Walby.
So we found lots of examples of tactical units being used for mental health calls, traffic calls, community policing calls, because all of our FOI data is broken down by type of deployment. So this kind of goes against the idea that tactical units exist to address high-risk situations, and it shows something very different, a kind of mutation of the use of tactical units, where perhaps they're not used every day for their original intended purposes, but because their members and their budgets are prominent within the police service, they're being deployed for other kinds of practices. So that raises the question, how do they engage in the work of regular duty policing when there are these highly trained, highly militarized personnel who are used to engaging in this different kind of police culture? Can they just turn it off? Can they just turn off these kinds of more aggressive, militaristic approaches to policing when now they're assigned to a mental health call, when they're assigned to a community policing call?
Beyond the weapons and equipment used are the unpredictable ways in which the presence of tactical teams may influence conventional policing.
Peter Kraska is a sociologist who's written about this in the United States. He did some ethnographic work where he went along to some of these training initiatives, and he also interviewed regular duty officers about their thoughts regarding tactical officers. And he found that the kind of high-risk, violent machismo of the tactical officers was something that regular duty officers emulated and aspired to, even if they didn't have the training. So he made an interesting commentary on police culture and how even the presence of a SWAT team can change the policing styles used by other officers when they emulate or admire the tactical unit and the techniques and the strategies that they're using. Maybe those officers have some ambition to join the tactical team, to undertake the training, to immerse themselves in the culture, and they are sort of starting early, so to speak. So in this way, the kind of culture that SWAT team or tactical teams have is different, but it may rub off on other officers who are engaged in regular duty policing. So it's the culture and the strategy of the tactical unit and the tactical members that is more concerning to me, more worrying, I think, for Canadians.
A recent London School of Economics study found a significant association between militarization and the number of suspects killed by police. And Peter Sanziak has noticed a more militaristic mindset among police officers these days. Sanziak retired from the RCMP in 2019, after 29 years with the force.
I would say, if anything, there's there's more of that kind of macho type of thing happening in policing now than there used to be years ago. Macho is maybe not the right word, but militant, militaristic. Keeping in mind, years ago, before you had all these intervention options, and I'm speaking about tasers and I'm speaking about expandable batons and pepper spray, police officers had their revolvers with six bullets in it and their fists and maybe a baton in the car. But certainly in the larger police forces that did rural policing like the OPP or the RCMP, they had to, by nature, use a great deal of de-escalation. They had to talk because your options were your words, your fists, or shooting them. And so police officers, by default, simply talked a lot more.
And how should police respond to people in the midst of a mental health or addiction crisis? Should this even be the responsibility of the police? Last year in Canada, approximately 9 people were shot and killed by police in what began as wellness checks. A painful reminder for Joanne McIsaac about what happened to her family in 2013.
It was a Monday morning, December, snow on the ground. It was -2, but it was a bright morning. And we had gone to work as normal. Everything seemed fine that morning.
Joanne's brother Michael was at home with his wife in Ajax, a half-hour drive from Toronto. The 47-year-old man had a history of epileptic seizures, followed by prolonged states of confusion.
Michael walked into his wife's home office and he was unclothed. He was irrational and very confused. He thought he was late for work, and she finished the call she was on and followed him back to their bedroom where he was trying to put clothes on. He really felt he had to be at work, and she kept pulling the clothes from him, and obviously she was trying to keep him in the house, and then he just ran naked from the home.
Michael McIsaac, naked and disoriented, began running down the sidewalk. His wife was not worried he would hurt someone, as these episodes had always been nonviolent. She was more concerned he would be hurt.
She called us, very upset. We were terrified. Our fear, honestly, was that he might be hit by a car, or that he might go to a park or somewhere and freeze to death. So we started calling all of our family members. I started calling Durham Police. I told them he had had seizures, that he had been very ill, and he'd ran from the home naked.
Joanne McIsaac obtained recordings of some of the 911 calls by concerned citizens before the police had arrived.
Do you require police for ambulance?
Police for a naked guy. I know you guys have had a few calls about him.
Yeah, where do you see him?
One
right
was
now?
Made by a man who had stopped his car to offer help to Michael.
This gentleman pulled up beside Michael and rolled his passenger side window down. And we have the audio. He was on the phone with 911.
I just want to make sure you get home okay, buddy.
And you can hear him say, "Hey, buddy, what are you doing?" And Michael said, "Hey, I'm going to Mississauga," which is where we are. And he said, "Well, maybe you should put some clothes on because it's cold." And he said Michael stepped back from his vehicle and looked down at himself. He said Michael was shivering, but he looked down at himself and he said, "Oh, yeah, I am kind of cold, dude. Thanks."
Just be careful. We're not sure if maybe there's some mental health issues. Okay.
Yeah. All right.
We don't know, you know, if he may be violent or anything like that.
So he's coming into a plaza now.
Okay.
Well, Joanne believes Michael was starting to emerge somewhat from his confusion.
I could hear Michael's voice. He was becoming scared, and he was coming to understand that he had basically what would be most people's worst nightmare. Woke up and found yourself naked outside on a cold winter morning. Michael's voice is becoming more clear. He's starting to realize he's naked, and he's asking one man, "Where are my clothes? Where are my clothes?
Where are my clothes? Where are my clothes? Hold up."
Michael turns around and starts to run back towards his home, but he's still confused. Three police officers arrive. The officers said Michael rushed at one of them, Constable Brian Taylor, while wielding a metal table leg and screaming. Constable Taylor shot Michael twice, once in his shoulder, once in his stomach, some 12 seconds after stepping out of his cruiser.
Two shots were fired, and then we have video. The man who was on the call with 911, you could hear he's clearly upset. He ends his call and starts to record video. That process took about 20 seconds. By that time, Michael is crawling, crying in pain into the middle of the street.
He was losing lots of blood. Twice he died and was revived, the second time while he was in the air ambulance on the way to St. Michael's Hospital in Toronto. Joanne rushed to meet him there.
I remember walking up to the bed, and there was so much activity and there was so many people around him. And I put my hand on his shoulder and I said, "Michael, we're here." And his eyes opened and he was terrified and there were tears running down his face.
Michael died the next day.
I think that there are clearly the officers in my brother's case. There was no de-escalation. There was no time taken to speak with Michael. You know, police officers should not be handling mental health calls, period.
Constable Taylor was cleared of criminal wrongdoing by the Special Investigations Unit. It concluded the officer feared for his life when he fired the two shots. At a coroner's inquest probing the shooting, a 5-member jury delivered 38 recommendations, including some familiar ones, improved de-escalation techniques, and mental health training. Joanne McIsaac.
Our government, our police forces are well aware that police cannot handle these calls. They're aware of it because there have been many, 45 independent coroner's inquests into these deaths. They all come back with the same recommendations. They all say there needs to be de-escalation training. This is not new. This is in the last 25 years. Every so often, there's an uproar, and our government will then have another independent review. And these independent reviews tell our governments and police the same thing. There needs to be more training.
A 2018 CBC investigation found that at least 461 people were killed during a police intervention since 2000. In 42% of these cases, there was evidence the victims had mental health issues. When it comes to the issue of police violence, researchers have examined whether policing appeals to certain kinds of people and whether they might be prone to violence. It's not the case, says Angela Workman-Stark.
The recruits that are coming into policing have sort of the same values as the rest of the society. So there's no distinction. It's not that you see that they're, you know, they have either negative or positive, different values. They're generally similar.
Workman-Stark retired from the RCMP as chief superintendent after 24 years of service in 2016 and is now associate professor at Athabasca University in Alberta. She says police culture can foster a warrior mentality, which can influence recruits to the forces.
And so the socialization process really begins in the training academy. And a lot of it comes from the sharing of war stories. And again, that's it. It's the war stories about incidents that happened. And a lot of focus on, you know, this type of interaction, putting bad guys in jail, you know, stories about rest and stories that involve violence, et cetera. So it's this kind of, it's kind of war story that really starts to build up this, the crime fighter warrior mentality as a prominent part of policing. And so the socialization process. So some people can either, you know, really get kind of caught up in that. Others, you know, happen to have really good sort of relationships with others that they don't sort of completely buy in and own that identity. But it really does start there. Then when you add in some of the internal dynamics, such as, you know, whether it's promotion processes, whether it's leadership styles, whether it's the things that are valued, such as, you know, being tough enough, being, you know, proving your masculinity, if those things become valued, you know, we see that playing out on the street, and it becomes then this sort of interaction with some members of the public where the police feel this need to display, you know, their aggressiveness.
As Workman Stark pointed out, not all police officers have this mentality. Many are committed to just and fair law enforcement. But what about the ones who aren't? A CBC News investigation found just 1% of public complaints against Toronto police officers in the last 5 years has led to a disciplinary hearing. And there's also a reluctance of cops to out their errant colleagues. As part of her research into police identity, Workman Stark has interviewed officers across the country.
And in my interviews, if there's anything I've learned is no one despises a dirty cop more than a good cop. But there are cultural factors there we need to really understand and unpack. So whistleblowers, or even someone who, you know, brings forth an issue that involves themselves, I still think there are ramifications from peers. And I think there's certainly what I've seen is there's a difference in the responses, say, from, you know, the leadership. And I'm looking at, say, you know, Canadian police leadership in this regard, that there, you know, there is much more of an effort to learn from and protect sort of whistleblowers that come forward. I don't know if the same sort of protections are afforded at the peer level. So, for instance, the individuals that I've interviewed have highlighted that when they have come forward, they've still, you know, been almost, you know, tainted to a certain extent by their peers for having done so. There still are some ramifications from the individuals that have come forward.
Workman Stark believes policing overall needs a major rethink in how the forces are led and managed.
So part of it is about, it's really critical that the right type of leadership is in place. The right type of leader is not someone who just necessarily come up through a bit of a tactical environment. We've seen that. That's not helpful. It's having the right type of leadership and the right type of expertise to support them in doing what they need to do. So, you know, and quite frankly, there's not any political party that I trust would actually be able to undertake any reform. So, you know, the expertise isn't actually there in government either.
But with the right type of leadership, Workman Stark does believe significant police reform is possible.
I'm not, you know, first and foremost, I'm not a fan of some of the conversations that's, you know, defund the police. I think that's just an easy argument, conversation. And what I think is really appropriate is think, what do we expect the police to do? You know, here we are in 2021 with the various issues that we have around the world, you know, exercising a little bit of strategic foresight. What do we expect that to be over the next sort of several years? And it's a really important question. What do we expect? What do we need the police to do as a society? I mean, it's very easy to say, well, we'll have, you know, different agencies deal with mental health complaints. And that's very well and nice until you have a very violent interaction with somebody who's suffering. Then what do you do? So I think it's important just to, you know, step back and think about, you know, as a society, if we and go from the perspective of sustainable societies, what are the elements that really help us to maintain sustainable societies? And then how do we sort of build that? Because if you go from the perspective of defund the police, you alienate the police and you alienate the people that are doing the work, and you alienate people that are, you know, very, very quick to say that they'll give their life in line of duty, say, you know, the individual that was killed in Calgary on New Year's Eve, for instance. So I think it's an important piece to think about asking the question, your police officers are part of society. So ask the question of what do we need to create sustainable societies and how do we build it from there? That's the conversation that I think will generate, or that's the question I should say, that it will generate much more positive discussion instead of saying, you know, defund the police. At the end of the day, if the police lose their legitimacy in society, where the heck are we? We're in a dangerous place.
You're listening to Rethinking Policing, the second of a two-part series on the role of police in our society. This is Ideas. We're heard on CBC Radio 1 in Canada, across North America on Sirius XM, in Australia on ABC Radio National and around the world at cbc.ca/ideas. You can also find us on the CBC Listen app and wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Nala Ayed. Today, the second and final part of our series on the role of police in our society. It's presented by Ideas contributor Kyle G. Brown.
We've just heard the argument that police are essential for public safety. It's a widely held view, in particular among law enforcement, that the police represent the thin blue line keeping society from descending into violent chaos. Jacques de Maillard is director of the Center for Sociological Research on Law and Penal Institutions in France.
This idea of the thin blue line is deeply shared by police officers in France, in Canada, in the US, or in England and Wales, for instance, in that they consider themselves as the last and most essential defenders of the social order. So this is very strongly at the heart of their professional identity.
Mike Huff is Emeritus Professor at the School of Law, Birkbeck University of London.
I don't think it stands up to a great deal of critical scrutiny that the police are all that stand between us and chaos. Most people are law-abiding and respectful of other people most of the time for reasons unrelated to the justice system. And on those occasions where there have been police strikes, the consequences are very variable. Sometimes chaos has broken out, but equally as often, nothing much happens until the police go back to work. One way of thinking about it is that our behaviour towards others is primarily normatively shaped by our values and our moral standards, and only secondarily by the threats posed by policing to misbehaviour.
Mark Neoklaus is a professor of political economy at Brunel University in London, England.
The whole concept of police, the whole logic of police is surrounded by a whole series of myths, and they are very, very powerful myths. One of them is the idea that without police, there is anarchy, right? There would be chaos because we would all run wild or run amok. And this is a really important myth because what it does is it draws our attention to the idea, the related myth, that police is the grounding of social order, that without policing, there can be no social order. And that, of course, then feeds into the whole series of arguments about how we have to treat police in the highest esteem, to allow them to do the things that they need to do, they say they need to do, in order to maintain order. And the idea that a lot of the early modern political thinkers, such as Thomas Hobbes, had was precisely that there has to be something to stop the anarchy. There has to be something to stop the chaos. And that thing wasn't necessarily going to be called the police, but it was certainly going to be called the state, which is why I think if you're thinking about police, you have to think about the state. And if you're thinking about the state, you have to think about policing.
And the state tends to provide police with sizable budgets and considerable autonomy, which the public has for the most part accepted.
There is something fundamentally insecure about human beings, and that means that they are willing to give up a great deal of their liberty in the name of security.
The public often perceives crime rates to be worse than they actually are. And this sense of perpetual insecurity generates a kind of dependence on police, a belief that they're indispensable. It's a belief shared by Pat Lynch, president of the Police Benevolent Association of the City of New York, the largest municipal police union in the U.S. Here he is in November 2020, holding a combative press conference outside a hospital where two police officers were being treated. They had answered a call for a domestic dispute, which quickly got out of hand.
Those that disrespect police officers, those that want to say, well, let's defund them, let's take them out of every different type of job, here's an example.
They were wounded by gunshots, but they shot and killed the suspect.
What would happen if the police officers weren't there? What would happen if we didn't have enough of them to cover all the radio runs? What would happen if a social worker was there and the police officer wasn't? So sometimes in a college classroom, sometimes in a council room, sometimes on a Zoom conference talking about policing, it seems awful easy to say, here's the script and here's what we'll do. What we see here today in police offices that surround us, see all the time, there is no script. We can't be removed. We need to be there. And remember, they called us to go there. And because these two police officers put themselves at risk, professionally went to that fall, there's no one else dead. The complainant's not dead. The police officers are injured. And fortunately, the person that tried to take us in a situation where you think it would be okay shot at us. And fortunately, unfortunately, we have to live with it, but fortunately, he'll hurt no more.
Some police work, however, has little to do with public safety and more to do with protecting resources.
My name is Pam Palmiter. I am from Eel River Bar First Nation, which is a Mi'kmaq community in northern New Brunswick, and I am also the chair in Indigenous governance at Ryerson University.
Palmiter says the RCMP have long acted on behalf of government when it comes to disputes with Indigenous people over land and natural resources. One example she gives is the protest over construction of a pipeline for natural gas through traditional Wet'suwet'en territory in British Columbia.
And you have Wet'suwet'en peoples living in their territories peacefully, unarmed, trying to protect their territories from Coastal GasLink pipeline. And you have hundreds of RCMP officers moving in heavily armed. I mean, they literally look like the military with snipers and these reinforced vehicles and helicopters and constant watch, dragging them off their land to achieve the purpose of accessing their lands. So on both ends, whether it's protecting our rights or denying our rights, the RCMP are almost always at the heart of it.
University of Winnipeg's Kevin Walby.
I would say that the relationship between extractive industries and police is concrete. I've located this material through access to information requests with the RCMP, with CSIS, and with other policing agencies. And so there are these stakeholder meetings. There are stakeholder groups, and then there are assigned or seconded RCMP personnel who manage the groups and share information from the public to the private sector and vice versa, which belies a kind of policing myth that police are non-biased, police are free of conflict of interest, that police are impartial. That myth becomes shattered. They're very clearly working closely together to protect the interests of those corporations, monitoring anti-pipeline activists, water defenders, land protectors, and construing them as trespassers or somehow engaged in criminal activity. It's something that you don't see in a lot of other sectors, such close connections between corporations and police. And there's a lot of detailed meeting minutes. There's a lot of detailed emails in these access to information disclosures. So they're communicating on a daily basis and they're relaying it down to other local police in some instances. And it creates this situation where Indigenous communities especially are subjected to, again, over-policing, surveillance, and categorical suspicion using some of these categories like Indigenous extremism or Aboriginal extremism.
Political economy professor Mark Neoklaus.
Ultimately, the police are protecting capital. It plays out in all sorts of ways. It plays out in terms of the kinds of people that are moved on from certain kinds of business areas or industrial areas. It plays out in the way in which police talk about why they've stopped certain people rather than other types of people. It plays out in the way that they underpolice certain other kinds of crime. So they constantly underpolice corporate crime, for example. They constantly underpolice tax fraud by corporations or members of the ruling class. So it plays out in all sorts of ways.
American sociologist Alex Vitali.
And that really is about maintaining a set of economic and political arrangements more than it is about producing public safety.
Pam Palmiter, the Mi'kmaq lawyer and professor, believed she herself was being monitored by the authorities. So she made an access to information request to Indian Affairs, CSIS, and the RCMP to find out.
And, you know, I got a fairly lengthy response from CSIS, which is Canada's so-called security intelligence agency. But it was completely redacted. And, you know, they give a justification for the redaction, basically saying they have the right to prevent subversive and hostile activities against the Canadian state, which is, for me, very funny because the way in which I advocate is far from subversive. It's entirely public. Everything I say is in a blog, a publication, a media, a video, a podcast. I'm very public. And there's no hostile intentions. It's all about how can Canada better implement Indigenous rights, human rights, and not kill us. Like, please don't kill us.
In the report, Palmater learned how extensive the surveillance was.
I think in total, I got about 1,000 pages. And it's about people following me, going to meetings that I'm having, of course, noting everything that I'm saying and doing an assessment on the danger or threat that I'm posing. Like, they had concerns that I was talking about Canada being guilty of genocide. Now, keep in mind, this was like, I don't know, 8 or 10 years ago. They were very concerned about my public comments, about me making Canada, you know, guilty of genocide. But that was going to come anyway. That came out of the National Inquiry just this last year that they're guilty of genocide. The other thing that they were very concerned about was me talking to First Nation leaders and reminding them that they are sovereign people. And that they have an inherent sovereignty and that they have their own governing powers and their own jurisdiction. And they don't have to rely on agreements with the government to exercise their sovereign powers.
In contrast to the hundreds of pages of documents that she received from CSIS and Indian Affairs, many of them redacted, Palmater received no written documents from the RCMP.
The response I got from the RCMP was a phone call, a very aggressive phone call, basically saying, why are you making this request? Who gave you information? What information are you acting on? That kind of thing. And I was like, nobody told me anything. It's kind of common knowledge that you guys monitor us under various categories. So I never got a response from the RCMP, and I didn't get one from National Defense either. But what we were able to find out, and when I say we, it's those of us who do access to information requests over time or people who do specific research, is that they do continually monitor what they consider to be hotspots, which is any group of Indigenous peoples advocating for themselves. And it could be a group as simple as the group of women, children, and elders who do an annual vigil every year. They light candles in memory of all the murdered and missing Indigenous women and girls who have gone missing. I'm not sure how they consider that a threat to national security, but those are the kinds of things and people that they watch, or Dr. Cindy Blackstock, who is the world's sweetest social worker, who has the First Nations Child and Family Caring Society, who advocates very strenuously in courts and in the public for no discrimination against First Nations children in foster care. I mean, the most vulnerable population. So, like, keep in mind, both Cindy and I, we don't have criminal records. We abide by the law. Everything we do is peaceful. We never make threats of violence. And that's the bar. So if that's the bar, who in the Indigenous community isn't included in their watch lists?
We contacted the RCMP and CSIS to ask about surveillance of Pam Palmater. Both responded by email. The RCMP wrote, quote, "The RCMP does not monitor movements. The RCMP collects and analyzes information as it relates to criminal activity. And the RCMP does not target individuals or groups who are exercising their freedom of peaceful assembly." And CSIS wrote it does not comment on, quote, "investigations, methodologies, or activities in order to maintain the integrity of our operations," unquote. But Palmater continues to have concerns about over-policing of Indigenous communities. There are also complaints of under-policing of certain groups, such as the far right. Over the past decade, they've been responsible for a number of violent attacks, from New Zealand to Canada.
You know, we had Justine Bourque, who killed 3 RCMP officers in Moncton, Alexandre Bizanet, who killed 6 Muslim men in Quebec City.
Barbara Perry is the director of the Center on Hate, Bias, and Extremism at Ontario Tech University.
And then Alec Manassian, who killed 10 people in downtown Toronto. That's 19 deaths associated with far-right violence.
Plus two individual murders, for a total of at least 21 deaths by far-right groups in Canada between 2014 and 2020.
During that same period of time, there were two, I believe, homicides associated with Islamist-inspired extremism. So a real disparity in terms of the real damage, the real harm done on the street.
In 2013, while working on her first study of far-right groups in Canada.
So that first project was funded by Public Safety.
Perry attended a government conference on extremism and terrorism.
And I remember the opening conference, and the Minister of Public Safety at the time opened the conference and did not once mention right-wing extremism. The focus was entirely on Islamist-inspired extremism. And the speakers that followed him, the same sort of thing. I think in sort of the opening statements, if you will, there were maybe two mentions of the far right.
And Perry says this lack of interest in far-right activity was also shared by some police.
So in some communities, we would go in and law enforcement would say, oh, and you know, and in communities where we knew from, you know, media reports and from our direct observations and the observations of community groups, we knew there was far-right activity there. Law enforcement would say, no, not really a problem in our community. You know, we don't really have a presence here. Or they would say, one in particular, this really was quite disconcerting, said, yeah, we know there are some folks here. We know there's a far right movement, but until something happens, we're not going to worry about them. So there was a real trivialization of both the presence and the risk that the groups posed in some communities. There were, you know, some cities, municipal services in particular, that were more attuned to the problem than others. But I would say the majority were not very attentive to the issue and would draw our attention either to the far left, which is what they were worried about, or to this anti-authority movement.
Perry says in the last few years, the federal authorities have begun to take far-right extremism more seriously. But anti-terrorism constitutes a relatively small part of police work. According to Statistics Canada, between 50 and 80% of all calls to police are non-criminal in nature, many the result of mental health or addiction crises. In his book, Police for the Future, veteran police scholar David Bailey goes as far to say, the police do not prevent crime. Bailey calls it one of the best-kept secrets of modern life, and notes years of increased police numbers in American cities had no effect on crime rates. Professor of Criminal Justice, Kevin Walby.
I think that we've tried to reduce transgression and harm in our communities for a number of decades through criminalization and public policing, and we simply have not seen a resulting healthier or safer community. And we know that the kinds of harm and violence that people experience often isn't remedied by police interventions because it's very reactionary. Police show up sometime later on, they criminalize someone, but it doesn't stop the harm from happening or the transgression from happening to begin with. So what advocates of police defunding and abolition are saying is, let's try to devise ways of addressing the transgression and the harm to begin with. Let's alleviate poverty. Let's make sure people have safe housing. Let's make sure that people have addictions and mental health services.
Retired RCMP Chief Superintendent Angela Workman-Stark says better accountability is needed for meaningful police reform.
So when we say the police are not being accountable, they're not being accountable by elected leaders. So that's a question too, right? I can look back at all the recommendations and reforms that for involving the RCMP, for instance. But if individuals are not held accountable to change, and again, at the end of the day, it's elected officials when we think about police and other mechanisms of justice, then that brings us back to there's a bigger issue here.
Workman-Stark says recommendations for reform have to be followed up to make sure they're being implemented, or else nothing will change.
The only police service that I ever saw that happen was a New Zealand police. 100% New Zealand police. You do a little bit of work on New Zealand police, have a really great reputation. But the government put in place a 10-year sort of review process regarding, you know, some incidents that had happened. But they put that in place So the police had to constantly demonstrate change. They brought in expertise, not only just to do a bit of a tick box compliance driven exercise, but they had experts that come in and evaluate the changes. And so those changes were never signed off on until some external subject matter expert had said that, yes, we see evidence that change has been implemented. That type of reform, that type of oversight, I have never seen that in Canada.
Retired RCMP officer Peter Sanzik says police leaders need to prioritize community outreach.
People need to feel that the police are part of the community. When I lecture to young people who want to be in policing, and I'll say to them, I don't care if my background is in Indigenous communities or if I'm in Toronto, I'm in Little Greek Town or Little Italy. The first thing I'm going to do is park my car, get out, walk the street. I'm going to go into the shops and restaurants. I'm going to eat some of the food. I'm going to introduce myself and get to know their names. And before you know it, you're going to get calls from them, from those people that you meet, because you took the time to get to know them. Like, again, that's a human condition, right? It ain't rocket science. I'm not a doctor of anything. I just make those observations that when you care about your community and you're in your community and you get to know them, that they will feel safe and secure knowing that you have their best interest at stake. And I hope that's where we can go back to, you know, when if we have strayed from it, and I think we have, I hope we can go back to that.
An Ipsos poll last summer showed that as many as 51% of Canadians were in favor of defunding police. Akwasi Owusu-Bempah is a criminologist and assistant professor at the University of Toronto.
For me, I'm interested in the defunding question, but I'm more interested in the detasking question. I think, you know, what we need to do is, if we are acknowledging that there are problems related to our models of policing and the way in which we police our societies at the moment, we need to have a good understanding of what the police are actually doing at the moment. What are the Toronto police officers actually doing with their days, and how much is that costing us? And then when we have information about what the police are actually doing with their time and with our resources, we can then determine what of those activities, what of those jobs the police shouldn't be doing, either because they're, you know, improperly trained to do so, or because there are other agencies or other organizations that could be doing that work, should be doing that work, or could be created to do that work. And so that's why I talk about detasking the police. And so that's not to say, for example, that there would be no police involvement with people on the streets. That's not to say that there would be no police response to people in mental health crisis, but they certainly would not be the primary response. They wouldn't be the first responder in those instances. They may be there for support.
Toronto City Council voted in early 2021 to launch a pilot program where civilians, rather than police, are sent to mental health crises where no violence is threatened. And there's a program in Toronto where the majority of calls from vulnerable areas of the city that were once handled by police are now redirected to community agencies that have expertise in areas such as social services, housing, youth, and health. So attempts to rethink policing are well underway. Professor Mike Hough at Birkbeck University of London has long argued for this kind of collaborative approach.
I think that there will always have to be some sort of bureaucracy in a state that has the capacity for decisive intervention to solve emergencies that need action in the here and now, and that they will require the capacity to use coercive force, but not necessarily the requirement to use coercive force in those situations. That's what policing, to my mind, is essentially about, and that the use of coercive power is at the core of their mandate, and it's really essential that the use of that power is done democratically and fairly and justly and in respect of human rights. But at the core of a civil society, you need a body with, like the police.
And yet it's something of an anomaly that police should wield so much power and not be subject to the kind of regulatory bodies that govern other professions. Retired RCMP Chief Superintendent Angela Workman-Stark.
If you think about, lawyers, doctors, nurses, they have regulated professions. Policing don't. And maybe that's part of the step forward as well, thinking about it. Let's really push it to the next level of being a profession with standards, required educational standards, you know, sort of professional development hours per year, sanctions around discipline, ways to sort of evaluate performance, et cetera. There's something to be examined there in terms of sort of raising the bar and creating it as something that actually has some governing standards around it, like other professions.
As we draw to a close, I revisit a question we posed to Alex Vitali, author of The End of Policing, at the outset of the program. What should be the role of police in society? Here's his more comprehensive reply.
Well, I don't think we know the answer to that question. I think we know that it needs to be something dramatically different than what we have today, that we need to undertake a process of deeply interrogating the things that have been turned over to police and in each case, demand the opportunity to explore concrete alternatives to relying on police, and then we see what's left at the end of that process. I'd certainly like to live in a world where public safety and security is not achieved by people with guns or by putting human beings into cages. And I'd like to be part of a process of trying to figure out how to get to that world and exactly what it would look like. But I don't know the answers to those questions now. You know, this is about a process within a movement rather than some utopian preordained, you know, place that we've pre-imagined.
L. Jones is a writer, teacher, and a former poet laureate for the city of Halifax. She's also a community activist who was appointed in the fall of 2020 by the city's Board of Police Commissioners to create a committee that will determine what it means to defund the police and how these funds could be redirected to better serve community needs. So we will leave the last word of this series on the role of police to her.
So it's easy to say hashtag abolition. It's a lot harder to talk about the mess of what that looks like because, yes, we are messy people. It's complex. We don't know how to deal with conflict and hold people accountable and how to heal. We don't know how to do those things. And we're not going to do them tomorrow. Nobody who's an abolitionist seriously is like, oh, yeah, we'll just get rid of the police and get rid of the prisons and everything will be fine. We know that's not the case because we ain't ready. As Rachel Zeller says, we ain't ready. Nobody should ever say to somebody who's been a victim of sexual violence, don't call the police on your rapist, unless that's something that person makes the choice to do. It would be a horrible thing to say to somebody, don't take the only avenue that's been made available for you in this society. People are going to need to do what keeps them safe. And right now, often that is calling the police. If you are a victim of domestic violence, what other structure do we have in place? Who can you call? Where can you go? So right now we haven't created any kind of other system. So for many people, yes, you have to call the police. That is not the argument. The argument is that the best we can do? Do we accept that, well, since this is what we have and it can be used in this situation, we should also accept all the violence that comes with it and that we can't actually do better. We can't build something different. Are there other ways to think about this? And that's the question.
You are listening to Rethinking Policing, the final program of a two-part series on the role of police in our society. It was presented by Ideas contributor Kyle G. Brown and produced by Mary Link. To read more about this series or to get our podcasts or audio online, go to cbc.ca/ideas. Ideas can also be found on Facebook and on Twitter. Technical production, Pat Martin and Danielle Duval. Web producer, Lisa Ayuso. Senior producer, Nikola Lukšić. Greg Kelly is the executive producer of Ideas. And I'm Nala Ayed.